This is the Takeaway Podcast for Friday, July 29th, 2016.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening and joining us to talk about history's main event in 2016. A woman like no other in American politics.
Tonight, we've reached a milestone in our nation's march toward a more perfect union. The first time that a major party has nominated a woman for president.
That woman, Hillary Clinton, takes on a man like no other in American political history, Donald Trump. Hillary Clinton had a monumental task last night to an American public who think they know everything there is to know about her long career.
The truth is, through all these years of public service, the service part has always come easier to me than the public part. I get it that some people just don't know what to make of me. So, let me tell you.
So, she understood she needed a reintroduction, but there is no way she could just show up as some new Hillary at this, her fourth national convention. Her message last night had to be consistent with things she's said for the past 40 years, but fresher somehow. And she needed to take on Donald Trump without shouting, without being dismissive, without appearing arrogant to Trump's supporters. There were some subtle and impressive uses of language last night to try and meet that challenge. Kathleen Hall Jamison, director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the Annenberg School of Communications at the University of Pennsylvania, has been watching Hillary Clinton's speeches and her use of language closely over the years. She joins me now. Welcome back to The Takeaway, Kathleen.
Good to be with you.
Just impressions off the top of your head before we begin.
The narrative matters. The stories that Chelsea told and Bill Clinton told are trying to put in place history about Hillary that is largely unknown, including that she grew up in the middle class, she's an advocate for children, she defends first responders, and she was there when that Bin Laden decision was made, and she urged it.
So new narratives, that was one of the challenges, and she certainly did that, and the whole evening last night did that. But listen to Hillary Clinton talking about fear. She spoke about it in 1969, and she spoke about it last night when she referred to the fear that was talked about so much at the Republican National Convention. First, 1969.
One of the most tragic things that happened yesterday, a beautiful day, was that I was talking to a woman who said she wouldn't want to be me for anything in the world. She wouldn't want to live today and look ahead to what it is she sees because she's afraid. Fear is always with us, but we just don't have time for it. Not now.
He wants us to fear the future and fear each other. Well, you know, a great Democratic president, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, came up with the perfect rebuke to Trump more than 80 years ago during a much more perilous time. The only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
From we don't have time for fear to fear itself is what we should get rid of.
And Donald Trump is something that we ought to fear, someone we ought to fear. One memorable line from that speech is a person you can't trust, you know, because he's going to be baited by a tweet, can't be trusted with nuclear weapons.
So let's talk about her evolution as a feminist and the way she addressed feminism throughout her career and the way she addressed the historic moment of her ascension to the nomination of the Democratic Party last night. First, from 1987 and then from last night.
The two main obstacles to overcoming the problem of battered women and children are men's attitudes and women's attitudes. And they have, to some extent, been enshrined in our institutions. And what I mean by that is that men's attitudes still, as you can see by looking around this crowd to see so few of them, do not take seriously in their personal lives or their public lives the problem of domestic violence.
After all, when there are no ceilings, the sky's the limit. So let's keep going. Let's keep going until every one of the 161 million women and girls across America has the opportunity she deserves to have.
In the first case, it seems, Kathleen, she's scolding almost. In the second case, she's saying, we're already there.
And she also is now speaking in a voice that is far more inclusive. So it is a voice that embodies boys as well as girls. It's a voice that embodies men as well as women. And in the process of telling the narrative of her life, it features her father as a person who was in the military, albeit briefly, as well as her mother. But the strong narrative is mother to daughter, daughter to Chelsea, Chelsea to granddaughter. It's a legacy argument about future generations in general, but in particular girls.
Four clips now. We're going to see her evolution over this very long career that she talked about. We'll begin with her speaking at her high school in 1992 while campaigning for her husband, Bill Clinton. Then we'll hear her at the very famous 1995 Fourth Women's Conference in Beijing, China. Then we'll hear her at the 1996 Democratic National Convention. And then finally, last night. Listen.
I know I should answer the question that is on very many of your minds, and that is, how did a nice Republican girl from Park Ridge go wrong? I mean, this is one of the great unanswered questions that we have to address. I was a Goldwater girl. I mean, really, we used to wear, you know, little banners which said Goldwater girl.
If there is one message that echoes forth from this conference, let it be that human rights are women's rights, and women's rights are human rights, once and for all.
To raise a happy, healthy, and hopeful child, it takes a family. It takes teachers. It takes community leaders. It takes those who protect our health and safety. It takes all of us. Yes, it takes a village. And it takes a president.
And most of all, don't believe anyone who says, I alone can fix it. 20 years ago, I wrote a book called It Takes a Village. None of us can raise a family, build a business, heal a community, or lift a country totally alone.
The evolution there is amazing. What's your impression of the It Takes a Village versus We Can't Do It Alone, the thoughts she had last night?
It's not only we can't do it alone, it's a direct contrast to Donald Trump's assertion that he can do things alone and that he's uniquely qualified in some ways to act alone. The rest of that passage by Hillary Clinton invokes all sorts of images from our culture, teachers and firefighters, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The inclusivity of it is marked. And when you step back and you say, what are you showing across those passages? You're showing two things. You're showing, first, a clear articulation of principle. Women's rights are human rights. Human rights are women's rights. But also an early argument toward the need for the collective whole of the community to act responsibly for each other.
We're going to play some very famous moments from Hillary's career. And it harkens back a little bit to that 1992 clip, which you heard, and I'm sure you recognize this sort of folksy way she's talking, like a lady who lunches a little bit. I was a Goldwater girl, she says, trying to relate to other women out there in America at a time of campaigning for Bill Clinton. It seems to me Hillary has always had a certain kind of identity crisis about how she should be in this particular kind of moment. And these two moments from very, very famous periods during the Bill Clinton time reflect that. And I wonder if you think there's been a real change from moments like these. Here, this first one you'll remember.
You know, I'm not sitting here as some little woman standing by my man like Tammy Wynette.
Where does that come from? What was the context there, Kathleen?
That's a 60 Minutes interview. They're arguing publicly that their marriage is strong. She's going to stand with Bill Clinton in the face of charges of marital infidelity.
And then here's something from 1992 that I know you'll recognize.
I suppose I could have stayed home and baked cookies and had teas, but what I decided to do was to fulfill my profession, which I entered before my husband was in public life.
Now, she got in trouble for disparaging the standing by my man or, baking cookies. What's happened since?
Well, first, that second soundbite was grossly and egregiously taken out of context without correction by the media. The end part that you played wasn't routinely played in 1992. She is not asserting, as the Republicans asserted that she was saying, that she didn't want to be a mother and she didn't want to take care of Chelsea. She's talking about a time before they had Chelsea, and she's arguing that it didn't make any sense for her a lawyer with a law degree coming to Arkansas to act as a hostess for a governor. Instead, that she should pursue her own interests on behalf of many causes, including children.
So, Kathleen Hall Jamison, do you think this plants a flag and stakes out a frame for Hillary Clinton to embody between now and November? Or do we devolve into a kind of negative campaigning with a lot of ads and nastiness that's really going to remind us of the primary campaign?
The convention was trying to argue for inclusivity. Stronger together is a very strong theme. They're trying to suggest that the country can reconcile differences. The question is, will the campaign actually accomplish that?
Now, she says you can't do it alone, which means that she's going to be relying on the other big guns of the Democratic Party. Will they help or ultimately hurt her between now and November?
The challenge is being both a legatee of the Obama presidency and also the agent of change. She needs to establish not simply that she is backed by those major folks who will remind people of the status quo, but remind us of all those speeches in the convention of ordinary folks whose lives she's touched, to generalize the broader message, which is she has a map to make the country greater, as opposed to Donald Trump, who wants to make it great again. He's looking back, she's looking forward in this vision of America.
And we're all looking forward to November with those great thoughts. Kathleen Hall Jamison, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
She's director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the Annenberg School for Communications at the University of Pennsylvania.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International, in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
The Takeaway team has had a grueling, exciting, and interesting 2 weeks going to both conventions, Cleveland and Philadelphia.
Protesters are promising to try to make a spectacle. On the inside, it's more of a malaise.
All across the Wells Fargo Center here on this very last night.
And live here from Cleveland.
Public Radio. Good luck when you're on real radio.
Todd has a postscript message from Philly we'll play for you in just a moment. But we discovered, as we often do on these assignments, that by the end of the 2 weeks, we were so geared up that we have a bank of voices you haven't heard speaking about events in Philadelphia. SEIU International Union President Mary Kay Henry spoke about her belief here that the living wage debate may be the real history in 2016 when all is said and done.
We've won more $15 wages at the bargaining table than in the history of our union, and people are reporting that across the labor movement. And the Democratic Party platform, in our mind, reflects the movement that's been built by low-wage workers who had the courage to strike and make a bold demand that 4 years ago everybody thought was crazy and now accept as a standard for the nation.
Congress may stand in the way, but union leader Henry thinks that may not be such a big issue anymore.
For us, the biggest breakthrough isn't in Congress. What we want is to have McDonald's, Wendy's, and Burger King sit down and create a national collective bargaining agreement with fast food workers all across the economy that we think helps state and local government act and create momentum and pressure eventually for the federal minimum wage to hit 15.
SEIU President Mary Kay Henry. So now, ever wonder what a superdelegate sounds like?
You don't need superdelegates. What you need is an open and honest relationship with your voters, one you hope is big enough and strong enough that they can work with you to get things done in a positive way. And if you do that, then you'll get reelected.
That's Christine Pelosi of California, daughter of former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, a superdelegate who wants the superdelegate idea retired.
They don't work. And as a strong Hillary supporter, I think she won this fair and square. It wasn't rigged. She won. Others lost. She earned this on her own. In fact, the superdelegates were what kept Sanders technically in the race longer than he would have been if you didn't count those 712 votes till the end.
And the very end in Philly is what Takeaway correspondent Todd Zwillick captures here, stepping on balloons and confetti. A final dispatch from the final night of the DNC.
Well, I'm on the floor of the Democratic National Convention where the confetti is being swept and the balloons are being popped after they dropped from the ceiling. 2 weeks of conventions, and what have we learned? Well, We've learned the power of the Bernie forces and the power of the left in this primary. We saw a Democratic Party and a Democratic nominee, Hillary Clinton, move to the left, give significant concessions to Bernie Sanders, and at the same time, Bernie Sanders trying to rally his loyal forces to Hillary Clinton's cause. And she's going to need them. A lot of Hillary Clinton's support among Democrats is still tepid. It's going to be a few days before we see if Hillary Clinton gets a post-convention bump in the polls after this four-day convention performance. Donald Trump appeared to get about a four-point bump in the polls on average. These bumps can sometimes even out, but they are important to the campaigns. Donald Trump campaigns today in Colorado, an important swing state. And Hillary Clinton, she stays right here in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania with Tim Kaine. Philadelphia is huge for Hillary Clinton's efforts in the swing state of Pennsylvania and to keep Donald Trump from getting to a point where he can amass 270 delegates in about 100 days from now. Hillary Clinton rallies here in Pennsylvania, then she gets on a bus tour and heads right westward across this state, making several stops on her way to Ohio. Well, I'm about to leave the floor for the last time after 4 days of conventions in Cleveland and 4 days here in Philadelphia. And I asked Matt Murray, a Democrat from Boston, if he was happy that it's all over.
It is over. Well, no. I think there's 102 days left to the November 8th election. I think we've got a lot more to do.
From the Democratic National Convention in South Philly in Pennsylvania, this is Todd Zwillick.
Todd Zwillick and the team of Amber Hall and Ellen Frankman arrest, and then it's on to November.
Our convention occurs at a moment of crisis.
America is stronger together.
I alone can fix it.
I alone can fix it.
I will restore law and order to our country.
Don't believe anyone who says, I alone can fix it.
We are going to build a great border wall.
We will not build a wall.
Americanism, not globalism, will be our credo.
A country where all our children can dream and those dreams are within reach. Where love trumps hate.
This is the legacy of Hillary Clinton. Death, destruction, terrorism, and weakness.
He's taken the Republican Party a long way, from morning in America to midnight in America.
There can be no prosperity without law and order.
Well, I will be a president for Democrats, Republicans, independents, for the struggling, the striving, the successful, for all those who vote for me and for those who don't. For all Americans together.
Actress Allison Janney climbed into the head of her most famous TV character earlier this hour, the assertive, confident press secretary C.J. Craig on The West Wing. She and Ellen Page have been reunited on the movie screen in another story about a baby that's even more provocative than the 2007 hit, you'll remember, Juno.
I need to find Nico. Please. I'm his girlfriend, Tallulah.
Whose baby is this?
It's his.
In Tallulah, Janney plays Margot, an uptight professor full of misgivings about where she's going and where she's been. Her estranged son's girlfriend, played by Ellen Page, has no misgivings about anything in her life, including the baby she stole from a drugged-out Beverly Hills housewife. Janney says Tallulah tells the story of women in extreme situations using their inner strength to stay grounded against all odds.
It's about being tethered to the earth or wanting to be here and be alive and be present in your life and a yearning for connection. And those are themes that I love. And I love that Margot's character had an arc and she starts one place and she ends up someplace quite different and quite hopeful and a great, better place. And all the women do. They go through remarkable changes. And I think it also speaks to a larger issue about motherhood and, you know, that not everyone should be a mother, but people make the decision for sometimes the wrong reasons.
The intellectual underpinnings of your character are this woman who starts from a position of intelligence about what she wants and has to get to a very physical, visceral sense of you know, what her experience is going to be. She's sort of brought to her knees by circumstances.
Yes, she is, and she's holding on to the intellectual, refusing to look at mm-hmm. the emotional and deal with it. And Ellen Page's character comes into her life, and she's forced to look at her life in an emotional way.
Has she eaten?
Not really.
All right, I think I got some cereal or something. Here you go.
No milk or anything, huh? Just like that?
Are you breastfeeding?
She's a bottle.
Well, why don't you make her one? And she needs a change of clothes. Where are her things?
Stolen.
Did Paige have any trouble shedding the brainiac qualities that she has?
She just relished every moment. She fell in love with this character and loved how she was unencumbered by what everybody else encumbers themselves with. She just is like this little elf sprite little thing that just didn't know any better not to do. Like, she just had her own rules.
Completely
life
free.
Completely free.
Right. A joyful dumpster diver.
Yeah, a joyful dumpster diver. She would love that. The only difficult thing for all of us was working with them with 15-month-old babies. Ellen had to, she's an angel. She had to be with those babies 24/7 in order to get that connection on camera that's there with the babies. It was extraordinary, and under really hot New York City conditions, it was a challenge for all of us. And Sean was happened to be pregnant while she was directing this, and with another child with her. And it was
not a boys' club.
It was not. We had a great. We had a female DP, female producers. It was a really wonderful female power movie.
There's always talk in films about you got to like the characters. Are they sympathetic? Are they not? And sometimes that can be a very tense discussion with actors and directors. In this particular case, none of these characters is carrying around any trophies in the beginning.
I mean, no,
hard to like any of them.
It is. And we as actors, we, no matter how despicable a character is we're playing, we look for that quality or that one moment or the scene or where you can feel mercy for them. And Carolyn's character, you do hate her when you first meet her, but then you have, I think, incredible compassion for her. And you may not think that she is meant to be a mother, but I think she'll be quite a different mother at the end of the movie, moving forward, than she was at the beginning of the movie.
It seems so many interesting, challenging actor tour de force movies are on this intimate sort of low budget kind of it used to be kind of odd, but now there's a whole sort of craft of doing films this way. And, you know, with the Netflix world and the sort of binge-watching TV world, there are just huge opportunities, it seems.
Yeah, there are a lot of them. A lot of it's, thank God for Netflix. I was just, you know, it's all changing now. When I was at Sundance and our film was bought by Netflix and people are watching things, it's different. It's changing. The landscape's changing. But the roles that I tend to want to play in films end up being, you know, these smaller movies that where people, not big budgets, but they take more chances. And
are there more of them now, though?
I think so. Time? Yeah,
I mean, you're getting gigs.
Yeah,
right? Yeah.
I'm working. I'm not knock wood. I keep getting to play. And
which probably means you've been so distracted with all this work and stuff, you haven't noticed the political campaign or anything.
Oh my gosh! You know,
going on. You probably wouldn't want to talk about that at all from the perspective of a famous character that a lot of people know.
Oh, CJ. God, yeah. I wish I were. It would be kind of great to have CJ have her own, you know, podcast or something where she could spout. It would be fun to hear what CJ would have to say about the convention going on right now.
How would CJ do damage control on the Melania Trump
moment
of plagiarism?
I wish that, unfortunately, we don't have Aaron Sorkin sitting right here, but I would not. I have no talent or skills at being CJ except for memorizing his brilliant words. Truly, that's
how,
why
how
it's
did
a big
Sorkin handle something like that. When things explode, you know, does Sorkin go right for it, or does he say wait for it to?
Okay, you know, when we did West Wing, it was uncanny how he has all these, you know, people who would be contributing, and he would manage to write episodes about things that hadn't happened yet, and then they did happen. The only time he really took something was when after 9/11, he wrote an episode about what had just happened to our country. But most of the time, nothing, everything he wrote came from
the experts,
whatever. He would put all the experts in the room and put a subject on the table and say, discuss. And then he'd listen to both sides of Republican or Democrat or, third party, whatever views on things. And he would use that and craft his, the episode. So CJ, she would talk about the Republican convention with Mrs. Trump in a way that be incredibly classy and yet drive home the point that something was a little strange there.
Well, it's a form of flattery. No.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is.
A form of flattery.
She would do it in a classy way where you wouldn't really, you'd have to think, oh, did she just, was that, did she?
If Cedar was actually, doing damage control for the Donald.
No.
That's a ride they wouldn't even have at Six Flags, probably.
No. Yeah, she wouldn't be doing that.
You know, I'm thrilled with the success of this. I'm also thrilled, I think, with how Sean stayed with this project. Often a director's labor of love is the movie you never want to get made. But this is so tenderly and deeply felt on her part and comes as a lot of things, journalists will see things that happen and want to make a story out of it. And I just am so in admiration of how she stuck with this and made it work.
She's fierce and determined and a really classy, wonderful woman who tells great stories. She's a great director, too, really knows what she wants and knows how to get it verbally. It's so amazing. I always thought, God, I couldn't be – everyone says, don't you ever want to be a director? I'm like, I would suck at it because I'd be like, can you just I need a – if you could just be – like I couldn't
be more
find
squishily,
the words.
Squishily. Say
and
that more,
she is so verbal. It's amazing. She can communicate exactly what she wants. And it's so wonderful as an actor to have that.
Allison Janney's new film is Tallulah. It's out on Netflix today. As Hillary Clinton's historic moment settles into memory, we want to let you listen to some speeches before we go that you did not hear this week. You might say they were taking testimony at Johnny Brenda's, the Fishtown Dive just outside of Philly, at the Inside the Political Machine Story Slam this week, where there was plenty of rage and hilarity against the political machines.
All right, all right. Hey, Philadelphia.
Mike Murphy, a poll watcher, has a story to tell.
I want to tell a story, and I want to tell a story about the time I was a poll watcher in 2008, and my wife and I volunteered for the Obama campaign to be a poll watcher. Now, a poll watcher is somebody from the campaign who goes to the polls, and you make sure everything's okay at the polls. You make sure the poll machines work, that sort of thing. You stand in the polling place and make sure everything's okay. So we got our poll watching assignments for the election in 2008 in November. My wife's polling place was in Rittenhouse Square. She was like, this is great. I'm going to go get some coffee, and I'm going to be able to have a great time. And mine was in Southwest Philly, very, very, very far away from our house in Southwest Philly. So in the morning, I'm pretty new to Philadelphia, but I knew well enough to know that that's just not an area of Philadelphia that I usually go to. So I get up in the morning, and I get a taxi cab. Now, this is 2008. This is before Uber. So I get an actual taxi cab, and I get down to the polling place. And on the drive down, the cab driver says, look, just so you know, I'm not waiting for you. Like, I'm going to drop you off. And I said, why? And he said, well, I'm not going to wait for you. I was like, oh, no, I'm not going there to buy drugs. I'm going there to volunteer for a campaign. And I'm going, so I'm like, yeah, drop me off at this place, at this field house. And he's like, okay, here's the field house. The field house was more of like a concrete shack. The entire neighborhood was there. I spent all day there inside the poll, in the polling place. There was a 93-year-old woman who showed up to vote that day. She hadn't voted in 20 years. That night, the judge of elections pulled his car around and turned the headlights on. And I said, why are you doing that? He said, well, the light broke. It doesn't work. So we need, light. 93% of the people that were registered to vote in that area showed up and voted. Judge of Elections gave me a ride back home, and he's driving me home. I said, thanks for giving me a ride back home. He's like, yeah, a taxi cab wouldn't pick you up here anyway. That night, I'm in Rittenhouse Square watching the election results with my wife and her friends, and we're celebrating. We're like, we did it. And I said, man, did we? I guess we did. I hope there's a change in the neighborhood. I moved 10 blocks from that neighborhood. I live in West Philly now. And I've gone by there before a few times walking my dog, and they fixed the light. There's a light outside that field house now. That's my story.
Mike Murphy, storyteller, poll watcher, slammer at the Inside the Political Machine Story Slam. Deborah Sharmalus is next from one of Philly's worst neighborhoods. She grew up wanting to pound on the doors of City Hall, so this story, starring former Mayor Michael Nutter, is a natural.
I'm from Philadelphia. I grew up in the Northeast. I don't know if you guys remember, but there was some time where you could smoke in Johnny Brenda's. And Mayor, well, Councilman Michael Nutter was, nah, I'm not having that. I'm going to put an end to that. So here comes a time where this bill comes to pass where he's like, there's no smoking indoors. And me being 10 or 12, I'm like, yeah, like, smoking is bad. So I go to city council and I speak. And I do this impassioned speak. I say like, do you guys care about me? Smoking is bad. You can't smoke indoors. And like he comes up to me afterwards and he like says to me, I do care about you. And I like took that to heart. I was like, oh my God, this guy who I've never met before, who has a funny name, really cares about me. So I'm keeping that in mind. That's like a defining moment in my life and what kind of motivated me. So a couple years later, it's high school graduation time. I don't know why, but this is the time where I have my 18-year-old breakdown. Nobody's ever gonna talk to me. I'm only 5 foot. I thought I was supposed to grow more, you know, like freaking out. And I end up outside of City Hall. And then I turn to my left and I see him. At this point, he's my guardian angel. He told me he cared about me. So I go after him. I'm like, Michael Nutter, Michael Nutter, Michael Nutter. And he turns around and he's like, yes. And I was like, well, my high school graduation is tomorrow. Do you want to come? A year later, I'm trying to make it work. I have a little hustle. I work at the Temple Performing Arts Center. I hear like word that like Michael Nutter's going to be there. Of course, I'm like, of course he's going to be there because I'm here. So he's going to show up for sure. So I see him and I'm like, Michael Nutter, like you may not remember me, but I remember you. And he's just like, oh, okay. Basically, I'm just waiting for us to hang out. Like, these things take time, 12 years to be exact. But yeah, if you see Michael Nutter, tell him if there's a short girl who complains about like Central and Temple Performing Arts Center, it's me. So yeah.
Mayor Nutter, just look over your shoulder. That's probably Deborah Sharmalus, your greatest fan. Our final story from the Inside the Political Machine Story Slam reminds us that however serious we feel the outcome of this election will be, there is a certain joy in American democracy, that whatever the outcome, it is the people who decide. Here's citizen storyteller and former candidate Andrew Stober, his sacred and in this case hilarious challenge to get the people to the polls.
It's 10 days before Election Day. And I'm running the first serious independent campaign for city council at large in Philadelphia. These are heady times. I'm talking with political reporters who are telling me, we have two stories written. One is you get crushed by the machine. The other is that you make history. We don't know what's going to happen. And I'm like, I don't know what's going to happen either. But I have some money left in my campaign account. And I have no illusions about politics in Philadelphia. I need to put some money out on the street to help get votes out for me on Election Day. And I'm texting people who are part of the political game, and they're telling me, he's a crook, she'll steal all your money, he's okay, but it'll only turn out 25% of the votes that you need. So I'm asking, all right, who should I talk to? You should go talk to Big O. You can trust him. You give him your money, he'll turn out the votes, he says. So I reach out to Big O. He tells me, I'll meet you at the Chestnut Hill Farmers Market. Won't talk to me on the phone, I guess. You know, you never know whose phone is tapped in Philadelphia. Drive up to Chestnut Hill. He pulls up in this huge Suburban, gets out. He's about 6'6", must be in his mid-40s. Looks like a former football player. Leans up against a stop sign pole. I'm convinced the stop sign pole's about to fall over. So he goes, what can I do for you? So I say, well, I'm looking to churn some votes out on Election Day. So What do you want? He says, well, I said, well, we want someone, you know, out there handing out my ballot on Election Day. Nah, this year, strictly a knock and drag operation. So I'm sorry, I'm new to this. I don't know what knock and drag is. He said, 11 o'clock, recites a list of wards. I have 2015 passenger vans. If you haven't voted, and I drag you to the polls. Now, in L.A., even in New York, even in Boston and Chicago. This is called voter mobilization. Get out the vote efforts. But in Philly, it's knock and drag. To be clear, we're still talking about getting 80-year-old ladies to the polls, but it's a knock-and-drag operation. I spent no other money in those divisions in North Philadelphia. I can guarantee you there were single-digit numbers, people, if any, if we're honest, who knew me there. But I won those divisions. So while young people being involved in politics is really important, so are your grandmas. Thanks.
We got to get a big O on the air, that's for sure. Stories from those who have played their part, no matter how minor, in our great democratic process. We're grateful to Johnny Brenda's and to the Young Involved Philadelphia, or YIP, organization for letting us gate crash this week's Story Slam. Also, thanks to our Philadelphia crew, Todd Zwillick, Amber Hall, and Ellen Frankman. Okay, voters, the torch is passed to you. Convention's done. Campaign begins. Have a great weekend. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.